From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm your host, Kennedy Vincent. Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. Okra. That's lit. Bet. Period. As you should. What do all of these have in common? Well, they're words or phrases born in African American Vernacular English, or AAVE. These words are often stereotypes, yet they also show the influence and power of Black people. The way we speak is not unintelligent, and it's not for cultural appropriation. Many of us in the Black community use these words and might consider them slang or ways we speak with friends. But did you know that they're actually a part of a dialect recognized by linguists? Today on Dialogue, we're talking about talking. With Dr. Charisse King, an expert on African American language, we explore the science behind dialect, the history of AAVE, or AV, and its ever-evolving role in society. Before we get into AAVE, let's set a basic framework of linguistics. It's important to note that dialect and accent are not the same thing. According to Britannica, dialect is a variety of a language that signals where a person comes from. It's usually interpreted geographically, but dialect can also be influenced by relation to a person's social background or occupation. Essentially, dialect refers to a whole group of language features, which includes pronunciation, differences in vocabulary, grammar, and how the language gets used. For example, people from the South say y'all to refer to a group of people, while on the West Coast they may use dude, or in the North, guys. Accent is a subset of dialect that refers to how words are pronounced and spoken, which is also based on geographical location. Here's audio from a 2021 Wired video titled, Accent Experts Gives a Tour of U.S. Accents, for some examples.
There certainly are a lot of different New York City accents, but they vary by socioeconomic background and by ethnicity and other aspects of group belonging and identity, more than by neighborhood or by borough. Here's something fun most of them have in common. The tongue tip hits the teeth, or close to them, on TD and N sounds instead of, you know, a little further back. So you can hear that in, like, this kind of New York City accent, tongue tip on the teeth, Times Square, New York City, and this kind of New York accent, 22nd Street, Times Square, Dumbo, taxis, traffic, and so on.
Hi, I'm Nicole Holliday, and I'm a linguist. The English that we see today spoken by African Americans has some features that have persisted throughout generations. TH stopping, so that might be using something like a D sound for where you see a written TH, so dat for that. You can hear that in this clip.
They said I could participate online. They said I could participate online.
L vocalization, so that's an L turning into a vowel in a word like pool or pull, might sound something like pool or pull.
He said that's cool. That's cool.
We also see consonant cluster simplification. If you have a series of consonants at the end of a word, you might see them turn into just one consonant. So in a word like West, you might hear it pronounced as West.
It's been a minute, but she just left.
So African American Vernacular English, also known as Ebonics or African American language, is a dialect, and one that changes throughout regions in America too. To learn more about how AAVE is different from other dialects in the English language, I spoke with Dr. Charisse King, a professor of linguistics at the University of Chicago. Her research explores how African American speech is constructed and racialized.
Pretty much, this is a dialect that has been studied since, I want to say, the 60s. And its documentation really started in Harlem amongst young Black men there and has expanded to notice similarities across especially predominantly Black cities in the United States. Now, in terms of its differences from other kinds of dialects, for one, it's a racialized kind of dialect, right? And so generally, when we talk about dialects, you hear about it relative to region, right? So like Boston English, New York City English, or even British English, right? People usually talk about it in that sense, but this is racialized. And so that's one of the things that makes it different. Another thing that distinguishes it is that it has a lot of different kinds of patterns that are distinguished with respect to what we would call the tense aspect system, right? And so when you think of, okay, what is that exactly in linguistics? That distinguishes, right? Tense tells us something about time. Aspect tells us something about how an event unfolds. And so African-American English really focuses on the aspectual aspects, right, of an event. And so if I say he went to the mall, right, past tense, he went to this location, right? He moved to a location, right? But if I say he be going to the mall, that's telling me something now about how that event of going to the mall unfolds. It means it's regular, it's habitual, right? And so that's one of the cool things about African-American English is that we just have a different way of denoting particular aspects that in standard American English or mainstream American English don't necessarily get emphasized in the same way.
You briefly mentioned how it started with young Black men in Harlem. How can you tell us a little bit more about how it developed historically?
Yes, the study of the field started with young Black men in Harlem. But in terms of thinking about it more broadly, and from a historical lens, there are kind of two competing theories, I would say, in the literature about its development. You have the Creolist side and the Anglicist side, where the Creolist side sort of emphasizes more of the West African kind of roots of the dialect. The Anglicist side sort of emphasizes the more English kind of roots related to how enslaved peoples related to indentured servants or British peasants who came over, right? And so the Creolist side says, look, we have a lot of patterns that we've detected that, you know, are similar to what we see in West African languages and can also be found in other kinds of Creoles, right? So like Haitian Creole or Patois, right? Like people have found similarities across these. And so they're like, maybe this is perhaps a language that used to be a Creole, but over time decreolized, right? And became more like mainstream American English. But you have others who are like, well, there are some patterns that align with what we've seen for a more working class British English, right? And so perhaps it is also through those connections that it developed. Right. I think people, scholars now kind of fall somewhere in between. They're like, there are influences from both, right? Which you can obviously see as like possible in different directions. But I think what especially like solidified the dialect was partly something having to do with the Great Migration. And that is the movement of African people, African-Americans from these rural southern regions, north and west, right? And this expansion sort of made it such that we were kind of put into these major cities, inner cities, right? And we lived amongst each other in these densely populated regions of other African-Americans. And so that is sort of the space or the stage at which it really began to solidify even more.
So how does AAVE function as a marker of cultural identity within Black communities?
Oh, yeah, that's such a great question. For one, there are so many ways in which it happens, right? I mean, you could talk about it through the form of the church, right, and religion and how using the church has been a means of communicating, right, a biblical message.
And what a lot of folk don't understand that you have come lately, you have come since the large building has been built. But at the beginning and prior to the beginning, the roots of the ministry are prayer.
We can talk about it in terms of entertainment, right? Thinking about music, hip hop, thinking about jazz, right? All these different kind of music forms that draw on the tradition of Black language.
When the pimp's in the crib, ma, drop it like it's hot, drop it like it's hot, drop it like it's hot. When the pigs try to get at you, park it like it's hot, park it like it's hot, park it like it's hot. And if a get an attitude, pop it like it's hot.
You can also think about it in terms of social media and the way that our language has been used to connect with other Black people that you don't even know, right? Across the United States, with respect to like memes and the comments, which just draw on our tradition of this sort of hidden language, I guess you can say, that we have with one another. And so it's one of those things where it has a way of connecting people across, again, locations in which we don't have family per se, right? We don't necessarily know people who live there. And yet these enduring kind of patterns that have been passed down from for generations, right? Are ways of being able to communicate with people who we've never maybe met before, other African-Americans. And so it could be very unifying, I think. And even I would venture to say that it is a tool that people try to use for unity who are even outside of the African-American community, right? Insofar as trying to perform coolness or wanting to belong or be in, right? Like, I would say that our language has been used even outside of the Black community to try and induce unity amongst other populations.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's a little bit of a hidden language in a way. What is the reality of African Americans not even knowing that AAVE exists?
The reality is multifold. So for one, you have some who are kind of denied their own sense of identity and like not being able to speak this way because they've been taught that it's a, you know, a bad language or it has no grammar when it's a really rule governed kind of dialect with its own patterns in the same way that any other dialect would be, right? So that's one way. Another way is that people don't know, because it is a rule governed language, they don't know that the sort of disregard for it or the criticism of it can lead to social harms for them, right? Especially if they don't know that they're a speaker of the variety. And so that includes things like, of course, job discrimination, housing discrimination. It can also include being disbelieved in courtroom interactions. Like, it can lead to a range of harms in the society that a lot of us are unfamiliar with. And sometimes we end up being the perpetuators of such harm, right? By denying one another the opportunity to speak in a certain kind of way if it, you know, doesn't fit into some sort of classed notion of intelligence or whatever the case may be, right? So those are, like, I think some of the ways in which we unknowingly are harmed by not being able to understand that it's a rule governed language. I didn't also talk about education, right? Yeah. And so, right, the extent to which our kids are getting informed pedagogy, right, that is really focusing on what they're bringing to the class as a benefit rather than a deficit.
Many people navigate between different speech patterns throughout their day. We have to speak one way at work or school, and then we're comfortable around our community, our family and friends. And in BIPOC communities, we code switch. It's as simple as it sounds. It can also be a way to protect our language and our identity.
The word that we use sometimes in linguistics is style shift, right? And so the way that you might talk to your boss versus your mom versus someone on the phone versus your homie on the street, right? Like, those are different scenarios. And so people are going to change to meet the circumstances or to accomplish different kinds of social ends. Maybe I'm code switching because I want to form a closer bond with this person. Maybe I'm code switching because I don't really know this person. And so, right, it's a distancing kind of mechanism, right? People have their own rationale for doing it. That said, I think that we have to be careful about what we assume the outcomes of it are. There's a way in which we place the onus on minoritized populations. Oh, well, you know, you won't have or experience certain kinds of social political harms if you can just do X, right? If you can dress differently, if you could talk differently, if you, right? We have these different kinds of demands that we put on people to meet. And so what I found in my own research is specifically, I do a lot of research in the legal sphere, looking at Black language and its reception in that space. And we found that when you give people an experiment in which you're just asking them to listen to a narrative, sort of like an alibi of a guy who was speaking with the police. We asked them to answer questions about attributes of the speaker on the basis of whether or not they're a code switch into like more of a mainstream American English accent or they're speaking as, right? And we find that people are more likely to find the defendant as having worse character or being more unbelievable when they use the AV guys in comparison to the mainstream American English guys. However, that does not mean that code switching necessarily buys us out of all kinds of discrimination or stereotyping, I should say. And so one example that I'll give is just like, even though we have this person recording the alibi in both dialects, and they were an actual professor, right, in philosophy, the person was still perceived as working class. And so what does that say about the fact that even when we're doing our best to sort of appear a certain way, we're still interpreted another? It's not always the case that code switching will buy us out of people's stereotypes about what they think Blackness is, and how that coincides with other dimensions of identity like class.
So you brought up the legal system. I also be interested in hearing you talk about what role AV plays in discussions about language policy and educational equity too.
For example, the Ebonics controversy. Have you heard of it? You know, this happened in like the mid 90s, I believe around 96, the Oakland Ebonics controversy, in which the school district wanted to allocate resources for speakers of African-American English in the same way you would speakers who are second English language learners. And so by recognizing it as a dialect, part of the goal was to help them to acquire more academic language. People had a huge problem with this. And by people, I don't just mean white people, black people, celebrities had a problem with this. There were celebrities speaking out against it. And largely because, again, to them, it fit in with stereotypes of what people thought Blackness was supposed to be, rather than like viewing it as a rule-governed dialect or language variety. And so like, I think that's an example of how, at least in education, even when we try to get to the space of recognizing it as legitimate, there are fights to delegitimize it, right? As a means of, you know, appearing more intelligent or appearing more professional. Although those things are not a good proxy for someone's intelligence, right? Whether or not they're speaking African. There are plenty of smart people who speak African-American English and plenty of not smart people who don't, right? And so I think that's a really good example of just the long hill battle we have in front of us. It's just, first of all, getting people to recognize that it is a legitimate language, and for even speakers of the variety to realize that it's not something that they should be ashamed of. And so, yeah, just in terms of schooling, people like William LeBove have developed, for example, certain kind of books, readers, things like that to try and help facilitate this learning. There are plenty of scholars working in education to address a different kind of pedagogy for teaching different concepts to kids, be it in the language that they, you know, are used to hearing or speaking. So I think there are a number of things people are trying to implement, but I think we have a long way to go.
Depending on what generation you're from, you may know AV as Ebonics. Throughout the decades, conversations around Ebonics were had on Oprah and in other popular spaces. But it also has been used as a derogatory term against people in the Black community. So the dialogue team wanted to learn more about the term itself and how a dialect gets named. Here's Dr. King again.
Ebonics. The word comes from, originally it was coined by Dr. Robert Williams, and it was meant to hook sort of ebony, meaning black, right, with phonics, which refers to speech sounds. And so it was meant to characterize Black speech more broadly. So not just African-American English, but in general, like all the Black languages and dialects. So that's going to include, like I said, your Creoles and Patois, as well as African-American English. And so in its original deployment, that was what it was meant to me. However, through the years, we've seen how people have sort of almost turned it into a derogatory term for Black language, right? I think people have moved away from it because of the ways that it's been stigmatized. And so you see people using it less because they kind of equate Ebonics with just meaning slang or bad language. When in its creation, that's not actually what it was meant to do. So I think personally that Ebonics is not inherently a bad word to use, right, to describe Black language, but it's also not without its baggage at this point, right? And just to talk a little bit more about the history of naming the dialect, like the first person to really do an in-depth study of Black English was a white man by, I should say his name, William LaBeouf. He went into these communities and started to document these patterns. And originally, it was referred to as non-standard Negro English. And what you'll find is that the names associated with the variety have changed according to sort of how African-Americans have referred to themselves. So this was during a time when Negro was a more acceptable term that African-Americans used to refer to themselves. And it has evolved, right, such that people have gone to Afro or Black English, right? There are different iterations of it. But now what you see happening is that even the term African-American vernacular English, that's the most, I think, widespread known kind of term for the dialect that has been sort of happening since, I want to say, like the 70s, people have been using that term. But it has evolved within linguistics because some people don't like the use of vernacular, right? Because they feel like it degrades it to something less than a sort of rule-governed language. And then there are others who just use African-American English as a result of that. And even further, the next iteration of that, coined by Sandra Lanehart, has been African-American language. And this is to sort of get away from the idea that the only study of Black speech that is valid is that comes from the stereotypes, again, of like working class Black people that were documented in earlier descriptions of Black English.
So we've discussed some of the history of this dialect and the ways in which African-American language can be criminalized or seen in a negative light. But it's time to address the elephant in the room, cultural appropriation.
This smoothie, bussin'.
That's cap.
It's like you left the plate clean. You ate it up.
What did they just say? Bussin', cap, ate? Well, you might have heard those words from our younger generation, forever confusing the older gen.
Thanks to my Gen Z son, I know that crashing out is about getting very angry. Crashing out is an example of slang. It's a relatively new expression that I learned only recently.
Many people who are not Black hear words like bussin', that's cap, or period, and think that that's just new slang from Gen Z. But in reality, a lot of these terms or words are older than the teens using them, and they come from AAVE. Dialogue producer Arielle Ravenet spoke with Dr. King as well about how African-American English has influenced American pop culture.
Oh, yeah. It is the basis for most of what is considered cool, to be quite honest. I think we have to be careful in equating Black speech with, you know, Gen Z speech, because that says something about the ways in which we assume that this speech is just, quote unquote, juvenile, right, or immature. And I think that's a problem. But also, like, we have contributed so much to this society, again, across different genres of the arts, right? Movies, music, TV, all of it. And our styles are taken up, right? And you can see this across the board in terms of like aesthetics, not just necessarily language, right? But even aesthetics. It's taken up, recycled, and sold back to the general public. And the problem is when Black people are exploited for our gifts or for the things that are racialized as Black that we've created. and not giving any of the same kinds of opportunities that maybe other influencers or content creators might gain from using or deploying these kinds of features in their speech. And so we definitely have had a major influence and impact on the society. I mean, there's even a book, one of which is my favorites, Articulate While Black, which talks about code switching that Barack Obama does during his presidency and how that code switching affected sort of how people saw him and influenced maybe even him winning the election. So this is not something, too, that's just limited to working class Black folks. People across the United States, across class boundaries, are capable of drawing on these tools in order to, right, influence different things in their lives. But I think just in talking about the broader influence, we see it all over the place and coming from all walks of life, especially all walks of Black life. It's not just limited to, again, like I said, working class kinds of backgrounds.
You know, going off of everything that you just said, what is the line of appropriation and genuinely influencing a culture? I know that, again, that's probably a big question, right? That's something that I'm sure you have a lot in class. But
yeah, no, we argue about this plenty in my classes. And I think it's a larger question in the field, right? Where do you draw the line at appropriation? I genuinely like to talk about these things in terms of what sociolinguists called social meaning and thinking about the impact of the social meaning that it might have based on who the speaker is that is, using features of African-American vernacular English. And so, like, in some ways, right, we see people who are not from the community or who did not grow up around anyone in the community using these things in order to be cool. And in some sense, like, I am not... It might be, you know, annoying for some people, but that doesn't bother me as much as the ability for one to retain opportunities as a result of using these things. So I think the most important conversation around appropriation is really the conversation of exploitation, right? And when certain communities are being exploited for their resources or for their contributions as a means of another community being able to make money off of that. And we see this a lot with corporations. Like, you have even places like Wendy's and McDonald's, like, beefing on the internet, right, on social media. And as much as, like, yeah, it's funny, people get a laugh, it's entertaining, ultimately is to benefit these companies and their reach, right? And the perception of them as cool or not. And so I think we just have to be attuned to the situations in which it's not just appropriation, but it's exploitation at some point, right?
African American vernacular English is a sacred language, and it deserves to be treated as such. The people who came before us creating beautiful words like okra and fam are just a small list of the power held in the creation of the words that we speak. With all the pressures that society may put on us to change the way that we show up in our spaces, I wanted to know what advice Dr. King would give anyone in our community who may feel like they have no other choice but to code switch.
I'm always in the sort of disposition of being comfortable to some extent, right? For me, like, I hold my Black language very close to the heart, and like, I'm only going to speak it with people who I feel like I'm close with. And so if I'm code switching, it's less about me feeling like I need to meet a standard of what professionalism is and more about, are you a community to me for me to use the sacred language with you? And so whatever your rationale might be, hopefully it's not one that's rooted in solely appearing a certain way before people, because, you know, as we know, there might be other things people will use to discount us or disqualify us in the first place. And so I think it's definitely about just reflecting on your own ideas about what it means for you to speak it and like how you regard the language, if you even speak it. Because one thing I didn't mention is that not all African-Americans are speakers of African-American vernacular English. And not all speakers of the variety are Black. There are other people who grew up in the culture who do know the dialect in some respects. And so, yeah, I think people just have to be mindful of what it means to them. They need to have those kind of personal conversations with themselves about what it means and how it represents them.
We are the keepers of our words and dialect that will continue to be here long after we are gone. For Dialogue, I'm Kennedy Vincent.